Welcome to another Salvation by Grace midweek message. Salvation by Grace is the teaching ministry of Grace Christian Assembly, a Sovereign Grace Fellowship in Smyrna, Tennessee. You'll find us on the internet at salvationbygrace.org. We are currently studying the Book of Psalms, so grab your Bible and join the congregation of GCA, along with our teaching pastor, Jim McLarty.
So tomorrow at 2 o'clock, I have the first of my follow-up eye procedures, which basically entails them shooting a laser at my eye to poke a hole in the film over my eye. And then a week later, they're going to do the other eye. So hopefully the end result of this will be that I finally get the vision that I was promised back when I had my cataract surgery. And the only reason I bring it up is because last night at men's group, I mentioned that I am going in to have this laser procedure on my eyes. And Micah suggested that I have the procedure where I can shoot lasers out of my eyes. Because then, if anybody falls asleep on me, they're in for a very rude awakening. That's all I'm saying. We're going to look at two psalms tonight, starting at Psalm 83. But before we get into that, I just want to read you portions of an email that I got just this morning. And it did my heart a lot of good when I hear from folks who are getting it and understand why we're doing what we're doing. It just makes me feel very, very good. Here's what it says. It's been several years since I've written. I pray all is well with you, your family, and GCA. I have finally found what I call the East Texas branch of GCA. And I have a steady local diet of sheep food at Garden Valley Bible Church. I don't mind naming their name since this is a church being suggested by a friend online. And people are always writing to me and saying, where can I find a church that is GCA-like? So apparently you can go look up the Garden Valley Bible Church. The pastor and I frequently have deep discussions, and many times he has asked me, what would McLarty say? It's a great compliment. I'm still chewing through the archives and YouTube videos as they come along. Many times I've stopped to write and then I end up talking it out at church and I get my answer, but that's no excuse. I should try to keep in touch a little better. I don't know if I ever told you, but in my life, when I believe God truly opened my eyes many years ago to what he has allowed me to know, you were the voice he gave me to guide me through his word. And I have cherished your commitment to his word ever since. That's very complimentary, and I appreciate it. On that note, I am currently going through your second round of Revelation, and I have a couple of questions. And then he gave me his two questions, but I just want to read the follow-up to his two questions, because I wonder how many people there are out there who have had a similar experience. Growing up, I never gave much thought to Israel and the implications of what happens to them. After 13 years of listening to you, I'm starting to get an understanding of the importance of Israel. When I first started listening, I used to get a little worn out from this Israel topic. Why does he talk about it so much? Over a decade later, it's one of the first things I talk to people about when they ask how I understand the Bible. Context, context, context. It has truly opened up everything. I used to be a guy that had no firm grip on theology, and a stiff breeze could knock it over. Now, by the grace of God, I feel that I can confidently communicate what I believe, and I am not shaken when someone offers a strong argument against what I'm saying. I have just learned to say, yeah, but what does the Bible say? The reason that I shared that with you and with all the folks on the internet is because that idea that you can't really understand the Bible until you understand Israel is an argument that I have made for many, many years, because the whole Bible is about a God who refers to himself as the God of Israel, as the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He calls himself the Redeemer of Israel. He says to Israel specifically, your husband is your maker. And all of these surrounding nations, the Gentile nations that surround Israel, all had their gods, like Diana of the Ephesians, and the many other gods of the various nations. And one of the things that I hope I've been bringing out in the book of Psalms here is that conquering those other nations is also tantamount to conquering their gods, their false gods. And that is why, as the Gentile nations managed to conquer Israel and Jerusalem, it was a completely personal thing, as we're going to see in Psalm 83. God took it completely personally. It was not just, you are attacking my people, but you are attacking me. It's very similar to when Jesus met Paul and said to him, Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me? And really, Saul was out there persecuting Christians, not persecuting Christ himself. And yet Christ took that so personally that he took it as an offense against himself. And the writers of the Psalms understand that relationship and therefore plead to God that the nations around Israel are trying to wipe them out completely, wipe them off the face of the earth, and that is still going on to this very day. And the idea of Yahweh being the God of Israel, the protector of Israel, the redeemer of Israel, is being played out right in front of us in world geopolitics at this very moment. The fact that these great nations of the earth have not been able to push Israel into the sea is because God has protected them exactly like he said he was going to do. The same way that he preserved the tribe of Judah until Christ actually came, he's going to preserve a remnant of Israel until Jesus comes again. And if you don't get that, if you don't understand that, then you're bound to come up with a truncated concept of what the Bible is actually saying, what the Bible is actually teaching. If you don't look at the Bible through Israel-centric kind of eyes, and you just think that it all applies to us, to the Gentile church in the 21st century, then you're not understanding the depth that the Bible actually has for you. And as I've argued for years and years, we as Christians want God to be faithful to every promise he ever made to Israel, because only then can we be confident that he's going to keep all the promises he's made to us. You don't want a God who can make promises to a particular people group and then say, you know what, never mind. Because then how are you going to have any kind of confidence that when he says to you that he's going to fully redeem you, he's going to forgive all your sins, he's preparing a home for you at this very moment, how can you be confident that you're not going to get there and he's going to look at the Lamb's Book of Life and say, yeah, you know what, I did write your name in it, but, you know, I thought it through and never mind. The only way you can be confident that God is faithful to his own word is if he is also faithful to all the promises that he made to Israel through all the prophets. And therefore, I am confident that he has not given up on Israel yet, and that he is going to regather them, and that Christ is going to return. And such an essential part of Christ's return to the planet is that he is going to sit on David's throne, and that he is going to rule over the collective 12 tribes, and that the blessings of God are going to flow through Jerusalem out to the Gentile nations. All of that is biblical. And people write it off by saying, well, that's Old Testament, as if the New Testament now negates that stuff. But there's nothing in the New Testament that would lead you to that conclusion. Instead, what you see is things like Paul in Romans 9, 10, and 11 affirming that all those promises are still good and concluding all Israel will be saved. Well, what does that mean? He's not saying someday all the church will be saved and the church is the new spiritual Israel. That's just language that he never, ever uses. Instead, what he says is completely in league with what the Old Testament prophets and, in fact, the Psalms have all said. So all I am arguing for and have argued for these 24 years now is consistency of hermeneutic, consistency of understanding that we look at the Bible at face value and whatever it says is what we believe. We bring our faith in league with what the Bible actually says. And if you're willing to read it for what it actually says, it says a lot about Israel. And if you ignore that, I think you're ignoring it to your own detriment because you're coming away with a truncated concept of what the Bible actually is about. So I liked that email very much. I'm very fortunate. I get a lot of very nice, complimentary, and encouraging email. And every once in a while, I bring one in here and read it with you. But that one seemed to tie in so perfectly to what we're about to look at that I figured I'd share it with you all. Psalm 83, as I just said, a psalm of Asaph, is a plea to God to deliver Israel from all of their surrounding enemies, and he is going to use the language, these enemies are also enemies of yours, and they want to wipe your people completely out of history, wipe them off the map. The kind of language that we still hear currently in the geopolitical world that we live in. And so here is a plea that I think is a completely valid plea to this very day that God would continue his faithfulness to Israel and his preservation of Israel. Along the way, there are going to be a couple references to historic moments and historic names. Hopefully, I'll be able to clear a few of those up as we go. The psalm begins, O God, do not remain quiet. Anytime that the enemies of Israel gain any kind of a foothold in Israel, when they are able to persecute Israel, when they're able to take over the capital cities of Israel, Israel then cries for deliverance, and if they do not get the immediate deliverance that they're looking for, they interpret that as God being silent, which is why we've seen a lot of that language in the Psalms. Why are you being quiet? Why do you hide yourself? Why are you silent? Why don't you answer? And the answer they're expecting is deliverance. Oh God, do not remain quiet. Do not remain silent. And oh God, do not be still. In other words, move. Move on our behalf. For behold, your enemies make an uproar. Okay, so whose enemies is he really talking about? He's really talking about the enemies of Israel. And yet, the writer of the Psalms personalizes it in such a way as to say, behold, these are your enemies. And they're causing this uproar. And those who hate you, because they have their own gods, they have their own forms of worship, and therefore the God of Israel is not who they worship. They are enemies of yours. They hate you, and they have raised themselves up. They have exalted themselves. They make shrewd, cunning plans against your people. And who are your people? Israel, because he is the God of Israel, and Yahweh is Israel's God. They make these shrewd plans conspiring against your people, and they conspire together, collectively, against your treasured ones. They have said, come and let us wipe them out as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more. That sounds like it's ripped from the headlines from yesterday. because that is still the intention of the surrounding enemies of Israel. Come, let us just wipe them out as a nation so that their name isn't remembered anymore. Because, verse 5, they have conspired together with one mind. Against you, they make their agreement, their covenant. And then he describes who these enemies are. And when you boil it down, when you look at these names, you'll notice that it is the same people group that Israel is dealing with at this very moment in the Middle East. It's the exact same Arab people that are still the ancient enemies of Israel. The tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites, the descendants of Ishmael, Moab and the Hagrites, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre. Assyria also has joined with them. They have become a help to the children of Lot. Okay, the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites. Actually, what you're going to see here is a list of 10 nations or groups of people that are part of this confederacy against Israel and against her God. And it seems that the children of Lot, specifically Moab and Ammon, are the ones leading this attack, and the other 8 nations are conspiring, helping them. Verse 6 tells us about the Hagrites, the Transjordan tribes of Reuben and Gad and Manasseh. You may recall that when they came across the Jordan River to overtake that land of Canaan, that they stayed there by the Jordan River, and they ended up fighting against the people of Palestine, particularly the Hagarites, who are mentioned there, who remain enemies right up until this psalm is written. So then, the tents of Edom, the Edomites and the Ishmaelites, who is Ishmael? Ishmael is the first son of Abraham. That is why God specifically told Abraham, through Isaac your seed will be called. But Ishmael was the firstborn and therefore believed he should have the rights of the firstborn. But he and his mother were driven away from the tents of Abraham. And to this very day, the land argument that is going on over there in the Middle East is a continuation of that sense of who it is that actually rightfully gets that land we know as Canaan. The Jews argue that it is theirs by the fact that they are descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The Ishmaelites, the Arab nations, argue that it is theirs because they have the right of firstborn. And so what we've seen through these many years of presidents going over and trying to make peace pacts in the Middle East, we see them making short-term agreements where they're not going to bomb or fire on each other for a little while, but then war always breaks out again because there is this deep-seated, thousands of years old hatred between these two people groups. And that is not going to be solved through American diplomacy. In fact, I continue to argue that if you don't know your Bible, you can't understand the world that you live in. People look at what's going on in the Middle East and they think, well, that's just stupid. Why don't those people just get along, just share the land, just two-state solution, that ought to do it. None of that is going to do it. The only thing that's going to do it is when the Prince of Peace comes back with his rod of iron and establishes his throne and his kingdom. Only then is there going to be any actual lasting peace in the Middle East. Now, I'm certainly not saying we shouldn't try to make peace over in the Middle East, but I'm also saying you're never going to successfully bring a lasting peace to these people who have such deep-rooted, long-lasting hatred for each other. And that hatred goes back to Abraham. So, of course, they would mention the tents of Edom and the Ishmaelites and Moab and the Hagrites, who we just talked about, Gebal and Ammon and Amalek, Philistia with the inhabitants of Tyre. Assyria also has joined them, and they have become a help to the children of Lot, Selah. Those are all people groups who continue to live in the Middle East. Deal with them as with Midian. If you look at Judges chapter 6 through 8, you can read about God's victory over Midian through Gideon, and by the 300 will I save, and God's great deliverance of Israel from the Midianites. As with Sisera and Jabin at the torrent of Kishon, God's victory over the Canaanite king Jabin and his general Sisera happened through Deborah and Barak and is described in Judges 4. You can go back and read this. So what the psalmist is saying is, you have a history of fighting for us. You have delivered us before through these really decisive battles. Do that again, because our ancient enemies are conspiring against us, surrounding us, trying to destroy us. Fight for us the way that you destroyed at Endor, so that those people became as dung for the ground. In other words, the dead bodies just laid there unburied, the way that dung on the ground would be unburied. Endor refers to the defeat of the Midianites by Gideon when they were encamped in the valley of Jezreel at the foot of Mount Gilboa and near to Tabor. You can read about that in Judges 6:33 and Judges 7:1. And consequently, in those environs of Endor is where that great deliverance and that great defeat took place. That's where Gideon attacked and defeated them. And in various places during their flight, they were destroyed. That's what happened at Endor. And so the plea from the psalmist is, do that again, where you just scatter the body of our enemies on the ground. Make their nobles, their kings, their princes, like Oreb and Zeeb, and all their princes like Zebah and Zalmunna, who say, let us possess for ourselves the pastures of God. Make their nobles like Oreb and Zeeb and Zebah and Zalmunna. These were all princes of the Midianites who actually were defeated by Gideon, and you can read that in Judges 7. So what the psalmist is doing is looking back at the history of God and saying, we know that you have defended us before, and you have sent us a champion like Gideon before. And even with Gideon, you narrowed down his army so small that it was clear that you were the one who was doing the actual fighting and the actual delivering. So do that again. Even though our enemies seem to completely outnumber us, we know that if you were to fight for us, that we would have a solid defense. So do that again, because these are the people who are saying, let us possess for ourselves the pastures of God. The land of Israel, this land of milk and honey, they want to take it for themselves, but you said it belongs to us. Verse 13, oh my God, make them like the whirling dust, like chaff before the wind, like fire that burns a forest, and like a flame that sets the mountains on fire. So pursue them with your tempest, and terrify them with your storm. Fill their faces with dishonor, that they may seek your name, O Yahweh. I find that interesting too. Not only is the psalmist saying, defeat our enemies, but do it for your own sake, do it for your own glory, so that they, the Gentile nations, will realize that their gods are not really gods, that you are the true and living God who will conquer them and conquer their gods, and then they will seek you, O Yahweh. So not only is defending us good for us, but defending us is good for you, because we belong to you, and this is your land, this is your property, and they are trying to wipe us out completely. But you, in your great grace and great majesty, should defend us and in so doing get glory for yourself in bringing Gentile people to yourself so that they may seek your name, O Yahweh. Let them be ashamed and dismayed forever, and let them be humiliated and perish. In other words, bring a lasting peace. Bring a kind of peace that is not going to be the same situation 5-10 years from now. Bring a peace where you humiliate them so completely that they recognize that you will always fight for us, you will always defend us. So let them be humiliated and perish so that they may know that you alone, whose name is Yahweh, are the Most High over all the earth. In other words, get glory for yourself. Don't just deliver us. Don't just fight for us. Don't just conquer our enemies for us. But instead, also get glory for yourself in the process so that they may know, as I've said a couple times now, that they may know that their gods and the ones they are counting on, the ones they are worshiping, were not the gods who were able to deliver them, because their gods are no match, no challenge for Yahweh, who is the very God of Israel, so that they may know that it is you alone, singularly. The first commandment, you'll have no other gods before me. God is the singular God. And the psalmist wants the Gentile nations to come to the recognition that Yahweh alone is the only true God and is the Most High over all the earth. And that's Psalm 83. And I like Psalm 83 because not only does the psalmist demonstrate that they as a people and Israel as a land belongs to God, and that encroachments against Israel or its people are actually encroachments against God. But he also says that God in his judgment, defending his own righteousness and defending his own people, brings glory to God because that is God's character, that is God's nature. His self-revelation of himself is that he is the only God and there are no other gods on the planet. I like that. I got this from the front row. I feel good about that. Well, now we're going to take about a 180-degree turn into Psalm 84. This, by the way, is a psalm of the sons of Korah. Korah, just like Asaph, is one of the musicians that David originally set up to do the music and lead the worship there in the temple. And then those leaders become prominent families within Israel so that the sons of Korah, just like the sons of Asaph, contribute psalms over the course of years. These are all descendants of the tribe of Levi. They are all men who are able to serve within the temple. And this particular psalm is meant to be set to music. They are writing it to the choir director on the gittith, which we determined before is a kind of stringed instrument. And it is all about the remarkable privilege and the great joy that it is to be brought to the house of God, to come to the temple of God. And this is something that was actually required of the Israelites, that 3 times a year they would go up to the temple in Jerusalem during those 3 feasts each year. And as they would travel in great companies and groups, they would often recite psalms, which were known as psalms of ascent, because to go to Jerusalem from any of the surrounding areas is to go uphill. And so as they were ascending toward Jerusalem, they would sing these songs of praise to God and about how wonderful it was to go to the dwelling place of God. And there's one little detail in this psalm that I just can't help but enjoy. which is that the psalmist describes a situation within the temple. If you've seen any kind of artistic renderings of the temple, or if you have any sense of what the historic temple there looked like, you know that it didn't have a roof. It was an open-air temple. It had walls, it had floors, but it didn't have roofs. And so naturally then, the birds of the air could be found inside the temple of God. And they would nest inside the temple of God. And the psalmist apparently sees some birds nesting, a swallow nesting somewhere near the altar there in the temple of God. And it makes him happy because even the birds find rest in the presence of God. In other words, it's not just humans, but all nature itself is benefited by the presence of God. I just like that. It's not just poetic. It's just kind of beautiful in its kindness and its tenderness. How lovely are your dwelling places, O Lord of hosts, the God of armies, the God who is in charge of everything in heaven and earth. How lovely are your dwelling places. My soul longed and even yearned for the courts of Yahweh. In other words, when I'm away, when I'm home, I long for the next opportunity to go and worship God in the place where he has chosen to place his name. My soul longs to be there. It yearns to be in the courts of Yahweh, and my heart and my flesh sing for joy to the living God. The bird also has found a house, and the swallow a nest for herself where she may lay her young. Even your altars, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God. One of the demonstrations that God uses at the end of the book of Job, that he is the all-powerful God, is that he demonstrates his control over animals, how he feeds baby lions, how he is able to control even the sea monsters and Leviathan, that he is intimately involved in every facet of his creation, including the animals that are on the planet. Remember that he formed the animals before he formed man. And I think sometimes we have this sort of narrow concept of God where we think, well, men, we were made in God's image, therefore God kind of hit his peak when he made us. And we forget that God is also God over every single sparrow, every single bird that we see. Jesus pointed that out when he said, behold the sparrows, two of them are sold in the market for half a penny, and yet not a one of them can fall from the sky without your Father. In other words, God is there, present, active in everything that goes on with a sparrow. And of course, Jesus' point is to say, and aren't you worth more than a sparrow? I mean, if he's going to take care of a sparrow, he's going to take care of you. And not a sparrow falls from the sky without your Father's presence, his activity, his permissions, and his blessings. And so the psalmist is walking through the temple of God, and he sees apparently a nest by the altar where a swallow is laying her eggs and bringing up her young, and that causes him to notice it and write about it and say, even birds have safe, secure homes in your temple. Verse 4, how blessed are those who dwell in your house. They are ever praising you, Selah. I think what he's saying there is even the bird song is a form of praising you. Because the people who come to the temple three times a year, the people who would be singing these songs of ascent as they are going to Jerusalem, they don't live in the temple. But the bird does. The bird lives in the temple. And so he says, even the bird singing is worship to you, is praise to you. All right, let me put all that together. The bird also has found a house, and the swallow a nest for herself, where she may lay her young. Even your altars, O Yahweh of hosts, my King and my God, how blessed are those who dwell, who live, who stay in your house. They are praising you forever. Think about that. How blessed now is the man whose strength is in you, in whose heart are the highways to Zion. So how blessed is the man who craves, who desires to go up to your temple, who desires to go up to Zion, up to Jerusalem. And how blessed is the man who has the strength to make that walk, and to climb that hill, to get there to worship God. And their strength is in you. And their hearts are about the highways to Zion, passing through the valley of Baca. They make it a spring of water. That word Baca can be translated as weeping. Passing through the valley of weeping, they cause it to be a spring. That is how blessed they are. It can also be a kind of tree that was in the Middle East there. But it doesn't make that much sense to say, well, passing through a valley of trees, they make it a spring. I think weeping is a better translation. That even as they are heading toward Jerusalem, because their hearts are full of joy to come to the temple of God, that blessing is overflowing from them. And though there may be weeping, the joy of coming to God is turning that into springs of water. And the early rain also covers it with blessings. I think you know that in the Middle East, they are dependent on the early rain and the late rain, the spring rain and the fall rain, in order for there to be a full crop over the course of the year. And so the early rain also will cover that valley of Baca with blessings. And they, the people who are climbing that hill, who are making their way to the temple, the people whose hearts are set on the highway of God, they go from strength to strength. God provides for them with each step and gives them the strength to get there every year. And then every one of them appears before God in Zion, in Jerusalem. So even the activity of going to Jerusalem to worship God as required is supposed to be a time of great joy and great blessing and great singing and worshiping of God, recognizing that it is that very same God who gives you the strength and who gave you the sacrifices, the animals that you're bringing with you to the feast, that he is the one who has provided all of the strength and the joy and the provision to come and worship him. And you go from strength to strength, and then every one of them appears before God in Zion. O Yahweh, God of hosts, hear my prayer. Give ear, O God of Jacob. Well, that's what I began by saying. He is the God of Israel. He's the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So Yahweh specifically is identified here as being the God of Israel. Think about that. Behold our shield, O God, and look upon the face of your anointed. For a day in your courts is better than 1,000 days anywhere else. Now, I will tell you that the Hebrew stops after the word thousand there. A day in your courts is better than 1,000. The assumption then being anywhere else or outside, being in your temple is better than being out of your temple. And even if I can't reside there, even if I can't live there like the birds, if I only get to be here for a day, I'd rather be here than anywhere else. I would rather stand at the threshold of the house of my God. That means standing at the door, going through the the effort, putting in the effort to get from your home all the way to Jerusalem, if you only get to the threshold of the door and don't get to go in, that is still better than dwelling in the tents of wickedness. To dwell in a tent is to be safe, is to have a bit of a roof over you. But the comparison that the psalmist is making is, I would rather stand at the door of the temple of God than feel safe among wicked people just because I have a tent over me. I would rather stand at the threshold of the house of my God rather than dwell in the tents of wickedness. For Yahweh Elohim, is a sun and a shield. He is your protector and he is your provider. The Lord gives grace and glory. In other words, not only is he giving you what you don't deserve, what you could not possibly deserve, but he is also giving you whatever it is that you are and whatever it is that you have, whatever glory you possess as an individual person, that is a result of God providing it for you. He's your son, he's the provider who brings the rain, who produces the food that keeps you alive. He is your shield, he is your protector. He makes sure that the evil of this world doesn't get to you. He is a God who gives you grace, who provides for you the things you can't possibly deserve, and he gives you the glory, whatever you are, whoever you are, whatever you accomplish in this life is because of what he has done in you and through you. In other words, there's just no good thing that God withholds from those who walk uprightly. And of course, that reference to walking uprightly is a reference to those people who were going up to Zion, who were going up to the temple, who are singing these songs of worship and praise as they approach the temple of God, which the psalmist is saying is the best possible place you could be. O Yahweh of hosts, he calls him yet again, how blessed is the man who trusts in you. Last night at men's meeting, we were talking about the difference between believing God or believing in God. And we were saying, you know, we all have friends, we all know people who are kind of kidding themselves and saying things like, I'll be fine when I die because I believe in God in some large sort of polyamorphous way. I believe in God, I yanked out the word polyamorphous this evening. I want credit for that. That you know, I believe in God. But the Bible doesn't ever tell you believe in God. In fact, James says that even the devils believe God exists. That's not sufficient. They know enough to know that he exists and it causes them to tremble. But there are people who have all kinds of religious concepts, religious ideas, and they think that they're going to be okay with the Almighty One because they say, well, I believe in him. But the question is, do you believe him? Do you believe what he says? Do you believe how he presents himself? That's why Paul put so much emphasis on Abraham's faith, that Abraham believed God and it was counted to him, credited to him as righteousness. So the great exchange, again, is that you're going to get righteousness eternally by believing not in God, but believing God himself. Whatever he has said, whatever he has written down, have faith in that. And that goes all the way back to the psalm here, that Yahweh of armies, the very Lord of hosts, who provides everything we are and everything that we have, how blessed is the man who believes you, who trusts you. Because that's the essence of what faith is. You end up trusting God, trusting that whatever he said, he's going to do. Mm-hmm. And that he is a faithful God, and that you can believe his promises, that you can rest on him, that you can leave this life and this planet confident that you're going to be okay in his presence because he has said that Christ was a fully sufficient Savior and that you don't have to do anything in order for him to bless you based on his everlasting love and choice of you. And that's really hard for us to do by our flesh because we just want to do something. Trust in God, faith in God, is the bottom line all the way through the Bible. Whether we're talking about Abraham, who believed God, or whether we're talking about the psalmist tonight, who in worshiping and praising God at the temple says how blessed it is that there are people who still show up 3 times a year at your temple, who still come and bring you sacrifices and worship according to your word, because blessed people trust God. And in the New Testament, we're told the very same thing repeatedly, that we are to have faith in God. We are to have faith that what he has said and what he is doing is exactly what he has intended to do since before the foundation of the world. And we, our reaction is to say, yes, sir, and trust that he knows what he's doing. So that is an essential element in the Bible, and I just really appreciate that the sons of Korah, whoever they are, wherever they are, and whatever they looked like, decided to include that it is the blessed man, the truly spiritually prosperous man, who has that kind of trust in Yahweh. And that's Psalm 84. So that was 2 pretty good psalms for one night. And I got nothing else, and I'm all talked out. Anybody have any reaction to that? Any questions?
Good stuff.
I got a pantomime applause from the back of the room. You know, pantomime applause is never quite as effective over the internet. So, yeah. But he's a mighty good God, isn't he?
He sure is. Patient.
He's patient. And he provides everything you need, everything you know, everything you are, and then gets glory for himself in the doing of it. That's a pretty sovereign God.
Thank you for listening to this week's Salvation by Grace midweek message. We encourage you to visit our website at salvationbygrace.org for books, Q&As, and our ever-expanding archive of audio sermons. And we invite you to join us next time when we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.